Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca Mesut Ozil. Alexis en el descuento ha marcado el Arsenal, como viene siendo habitual esta temporada. Gol de Alexis, 1-0 Arsenal.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello there, welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always with James from Gunnarblog. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good weekend.
Yes, very good weekend. It was Halloween here, but you wouldn't really have noticed. Around where I live, it's a little bit dangerous, so no kids actually come and trick-or-treat or anything. There's a kind of pervasive fear that prevents them doing that.
Well, what's in your area? Monsters or bad people?
I'm here, for one. No, I don't know. Bad people. That's the way it goes. I mean, actually, it's fine. But, it's not the kind of neighbourhood where people are encouraged to wander around unarmed at night. What about you? Good weekend?
Yes. Yeah. A little bit too good on Saturday night, I think. But there you go.
Well,
you know, I'm recovered. Before we get on to the Arsenal thing, I just wanted to talk about something that happened yesterday in the Manchester Derby that seems to have gone completely under the radar or not mentioned. Joe Hart came thundering out of his goal and put his head on the referee, Michael Oliver, in a way that we've seen players get sent off for doing it to another player. Mm. Any particular reason you can think of why this has been completely glossed over? Sky didn't even seem to mention it.
That is strange, isn't it?
Mm.
I don't know. Maybe it's because he's an Englishman. Does that play into it at all?
Maybe.
We've seen the likes of Alan Shearer and John Terry get away with some things on the pitch that, you know, no other player seemingly would because they were high-profile England internationals, and perhaps because of that they had a close relationship with the referees. It does seem odd, doesn't it? I mean, you imagine if it had been a different player, the consequences might have been far greater.
Or a different referee. You know, yeah. He just seemed to stand there and take it, which, He's an odd one. But the standard of refereeing, of course, this season and over the past few seasons, I think, has been decreasing fairly rapidly.
Yeah.
It's bad.
I think it's not... sorry about that. That was me re-watching the incident. I think the standard of refereeing has got bad. And one of the things that does rile you a little bit is when... It's horrible when you see referees sort of calling some of the England players like by their first name and things like that. Do you know what I mean?
Wazza.
Yeah, Wazza. Not a huge fan of that, I've got to say.
Mm.
And it feels like this is another one of those instances where the nature of that relationship has been a factor. But referees should be stronger than that, really.
Yeah, all right. Okay, well, look, let's leave that to one side and discuss what was, in the end, a good win. We did leave it a little bit late, though. To be like hugely comfortable about the whole thing, which isn't to say we weren't dominant in the game, and we were, and I think we played pretty well overall, just couldn't find the breakthrough until Alexis did his stuff, and we'll come to him in a moment. But interesting as well that we played a 4-4-2 for the first time in what seems like ages.
Yeah, and I've got to be honest, I didn't think we would see that.
Did he not say that in the press conference a few weeks back, though? He did say we'll do it from time to time.
He did. I think he said it. It might have been in that video where a number of Arsenal bloggers asked him questions and he answered. I remember him being asked about 4-4-2 in that, perhaps by at Geezy Peas, and he said, "Yeah, I'll be bringing it out." But he said things like that before, you know, things like, oh, we'll give Theo Walcott a chance through the middle, and then it never really materialised. You know, I don't always take him at his word, but he's
Park
as good
will
as
be
his
an
words.
Asset for us.
Exactly, yeah. But he did use it. It became very clear as soon as the game started that it was a 4-4-2. anecdotally, in the press conference room after the match, a lot of journalists were sort of turning around saying, oh, I don't think it was a 4-4-2, despite the fact that Arsene himself had confirmed it. It was quite strange. Mm. Maybe they'd already written their match reports and didn't want to change it. But I think it's really encouraging, because I think against a team like Burnley, who did defend very deep and very compact, it's really useful to have, you know, two men who you can hit into feet or however you want to do it. And it just gives you that extra presence. I thought it was promising that we showed a bit of flexibility.
Mm. I mean, some of that obviously was to do with the fact he expected Burnley also to play a 4-4-2, you know, which wouldn't leave us overrun in midfield. And did that then explain the decision to start both Arteta and Flamini, which, considering the opposition, some people have said it was a bit unambitious, a bit too cautious. I mean, do you balance that? Because, you know, we are still, let's face it, a team that is very slowly building some confidence and form.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, after the match, when he was asked about the system, he said it was a 4-4-2, and that means you have to try and get a bit of a balance between attack and defence. And I think, you know, he sought to achieve that balance by having Arteta and Flamini in there. I think if you had, you know, the mythical DM in there, you could probably play Aaron Ramsey in there too and have enough cover. But I don't think Arteta or Flamini on their own perhaps are strong enough to play that role in a 4-4-2. So maybe he feels he needs the security of both in there. Mm. But I think, as you pointed out on your blog, it was telling that when Aaron Ramsey came on, certainly our tempo and, you know, the number of chances we created increased.
What do you think the issue with Ramsey is just at the moment? Is there a sense that perhaps he's still not quite 100% fit? And given the opposition that we're facing at the moment, this is a time to let him rest up a bit, let him get properly fit. I think he said after the game that he's being super cautious with Ramsey at the moment.
Mm. Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it? Because he was expected to be out for quite a long time, then he came back quite early, but he's not come back as a regular into the starting lineup. I can only assume that there is some sort of underlying issue. You'd have to think that 100% Aaron Ramsey would be starting week in, week out at this stage.
Yeah.
And I guess we'd all rather that Arsene was cautious rather than that he suffered any kind of recurrence. So, you know, it's difficult to complain too much about that. I think it must be to do with physical, don't you think?
Yeah, I would have thought so. You know, like you say, if he's fully fit, he's got to start because of the impact that he has and has had over the last 12 months. So, you know, without all the information to hand, and we don't have all the medical information, you know, my assumption is that he is being very cautious with him and doesn't want to, you know, put him in a position where there's a recurrence of any injury or anything like that. So maybe he is acting on advice where they're saying he's a little bit, you know, in that fabled zone of redness, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. Well, on the subject of central midfield, I didn't get the impression you particularly enjoyed Mathieu Flamini's performance of the weekend.
No, I thought he did quite good stuff, but there was this 2-minute spell in the second half where he just was wandering around the place. He booted the ball miles up in the air. He was crunching into tackles and missing the ball, and it was a bit odd, you know. I was surprised that he stayed on rather than Arteta, to be honest. Given that we were going to be a bit more ambitious, I would have thought Arteta, just in terms of controlling the play and the passing and the way that he could dictate that from deeper, you know, he is perhaps better on the ball than Flamini. But, you know, I don't know. I don't suppose the expectation level can be that high. He is what he is, and he does what he does, and for the most part, he does it all right. But I think he's, you know, he's struggled at times this season in terms of his form. And there was one moment, I think it was in the first half, could be wrong, where he chased a ball down the touchline towards the left back position, where, in fairness, he was covering, but clumped it straight into the path of a Burnley player. You know, and if that's better opposition, perhaps you get hurt. So yeah. I just think there's been a moment in almost every game that could have proved really costly with him in the last few weeks. So that's why I was just a little bit surprised. I thought that if Ramsey was going to come back into the team on Saturday, it would have been at the expense of Flamini rather than Arteta.
Yeah, I think so. And maybe that will be the case in the coming games. We'll have to wait and see on that one.
Mm, all right. Well, look, we can go no longer without discussing Alexis.
We've done well. We've got quite far.
Yeah, we have. 10 minutes, practically. Maybe.
Wow. Not bad. I wouldn't have put money on that.
What more can we say about him that we haven't already said? The first goal, Arsene Wenger called it an English goal, in the sense that, you know, it's not like a slick passing football or South American skills. It's a small guy leaping between two big central defenders and nodding the ball home. I mean, I didn't know he had that kind of goal in his locker, really. But I'm glad to be surprised consistently by what he does and how he does it.
Pretty amazing. I mean, I don't know if you saw Match of the Day, but I think they did a graphic after the game which showed that at the point where he met the ball, I think he was 6'10".
Yes, I saw that, yeah.
Pretty incredible, really. I think he's 5'7", so it's a hell of a leap. And his marker, I think, was 6'4". Mm. I mean, obviously he's got a running jump on that guy, but the athleticism and the desire to score that goal is just phenomenal, really. Mm.
That's what Wenger said, wasn't it? It was a goal that was born out of desire and determination than anything brilliant technically. But, I think that there's a balance to be found there, because there is something very technical about timing your run, about tracking the flight of the ball, about being good enough to do that between two central defenders. I think, you know, perhaps did him a little bit of a disservice. It was desire and it was determination, and you could see that that played a huge part in it. But there is a technical element too.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that tells you a bit about Wenger's tastes in some respects, that he's not particularly inclined to praise the technique of a goal like that, because there is an awful lot, as you say, and athleticism in spades. But I also think, you know, what new did we learn about him? This was the game where really, for me, I saw him as someone who is a leader. You know, Arsene always talks about it's important to have different captains on the field. And, you know, Alexis is a great example of someone who leads without the armband, without even speaking the language. He doesn't have to be shouting at his teammates to set an example. He's always willing to take the ball, always willing to take a risk, always willing to try and make something happen. And the responsibility that he showed, and it shows in those figures that have come out since the game, you know, Arsene talking about how many times he scores the important goals. You know, he's no Tomasz Rosicki, icing on the cake man. He scores the goals that break games. I think that is hugely invaluable to this team. And again, just speaks volumes about his character and personality.
Mm. Theo Walcott made some comments after the game. To a certain extent, I understand them. Because he was talking about, you know, how they're trying to tell him, look, you don't get a winter break here.
Right. I haven't seen those, I have to say.
Yeah. I mean, it was nothing. He was just saying he's brilliant. And even on his recovery days, he wants to play. And we're telling him, look, chill out a bit. You don't get a winter break here. And I understand that to a certain extent. And there are lots of questions today that have been sent our way about whether or not Alexis can keep it up for the season, or if he's going to suffer from burnout. And, you know, I understand people's fear on that as well. But my thinking on it is, look, if you've got this guy doing that in your team, the last thing you want to do is tell him, look, you know, just chill out a bit. No, it's keep doing that. And why don't we do more to ensure that he can keep doing that?
Yeah.
Where do you stand on that one?
Well, what can I say? Against Burnley, I was at 2-0. I did wonder if they might give Alexis a rest. I did wonder if they might bring him off for the last 10 minutes or so, because in the form that he's in, he has to start absolutely every single game for us.
Yeah.
They didn't. Now, there is the argument that they just deem it unnecessary because he's got that Duracell bunny style relentlessness that means he can just keep going. I think that as the season wears on into the winter, you will see him withdrawn from games a little more just to protect him. I don't think it's reasonable to expect him to play every minute of his first season in English football. But I do think that the evidence seems to suggest that he does have the capacity to handle it at present. You know, certain players do. So I don't think it's too much of a pressing concern. Theo's probably just hoping that Alexis needs a rest at some point so he can get back in the team.
I mean, it is one of those things for a manager that's very difficult because on the one hand, you have people going, well, you know, we've got to give him a rest. We can't burn him out. He's so important. But on the other hand, he's so important because he's doing what he's doing. Mm. Is there a chance that, you know, maybe we're just conditioned in that way as Arsenal fans that we are looking at him and rather than enjoying completely what he's doing, we're immediately looking for the dark side, the negative side, because of the injuries that we pick up, because it's happened before, that we're just afraid that this is a kind of a fear-based thing rather than anything that's based in rationality.
Yeah, well, I mean, Alexis at Barcelona did have a slight history of muscular injuries. I know I can feel every listener tensing up as I say that. And there was actually a really interesting moment captured on camera once. I think Graham Hunter referred to this in one of his slightly negative pieces about Alexis when Arsenal signed him, whereby Alexis was chasing down a ball in the, I don't know, 80th minute or something with a game won and pulled up with his hamstring. And as he was sort of taken off the pitch injured, Guardiola was screaming at him, 90 minutes, because you know, Alexis basically he didn't pace himself properly. Mm. And this became a tendency that he would overdo it and get injured early. Now, somehow, by some miracle touch of the gods, that hasn't yet happened at Arsenal, and God forbid it does, because as I say, he's absolutely invaluable at the moment. Mm. Yeah, maybe we are conditioned to think negatively. I do have little concerns about it, just because, I don't know, as fresh as he looks, game in, game out, can that possibly last across the season? I don't know. I mean, it seems superhuman, but he's amazed me on so many levels so far. Maybe he can do it. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I just think, I think you have to be a little bit sensible, and perhaps when it is 2-0, you could take him off and you could give him a rest, because the game is won. I don't think Burnley were coming back from 2-0 down. But then, yeah, I suppose as long as he's playing the way he's playing, the temptation is to just leave him on, because the more you win or the better you win, the more confidence you gain as well. So I think the manager's trying to deal with that a little bit. Okay, well, look, we'll leave him there. Just quickly on Theo Walcott, his comeback, first game since January, since that cruciate injury. Good to have him back, and obviously he's going to be eased into action over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, and admittedly it was against a very tired Burnley side. You know, the tide was very much with Arsenal at that point. But I thought he looked pretty sharp, sharper than maybe I'd expect. There were a couple of runs, you know, between defenders, and that shot that was well turned over by a keeper who had a brilliant game, you have to say. Mm. So, yeah, I thought the signs were encouraging, didn't you?
Yeah, he's bulked up a bit as well, hasn't he? Looks like he's obviously spent some time in the gym.
Yeah, and it was interesting hearing him talk last week, I think. He said that because of the way his career accelerated so quickly through his teens, because he was sort of straight into the first team picture as a teenager, he feels a little bit like he missed out on some of that gym work, which I think can, you know, fill some of the time when you're going through the kind of academy process. Mm. And so being out for that long has actually enabled him to do a bit of catch up there. So fingers crossed that, you know, that will help him on the field and also maybe prevent more injuries in future.
Theo Beefcake.
Indeed.
All right. Okay. That's that for part one. We're going to take a short break. We're back with your questions in part two right after this. If two Arscasts a week aren't enough for you, remember, you can get the audiobook version of Together, the story of Arsenal's unbeaten season. It's available to download now from shop.arsblog.com. Shop.arsblog.com. The important part is to make sure you sign up for an account with the shop before you make the purchase. Then you'll be emailed the download link. Then the files are yours to download to listen on your phone, computer, whatever you like. It's shop.arsblog.com. It's a book in your ears. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. Right now, it's the part of the show where we take your questions sent to us on Twitter, at Gunnerblog and at Arsblog. And the first question today comes from Rob Ashdown. And he wants to know, it's Wrighty's birthday today. So what are your favourite moments of Wright magic?
There are so many. He was absolutely my favourite player in the kind of mid-90s. And in fact, when he left Arsenal, I was pretty bereft. I genuinely was. He went to West Ham and I was like, do I have to like West Ham now? I was quite young at the time. I didn't really understand what was happening. But it laid the groundwork for my parents' eventual divorce. My favourite Wright moment, the one that sticks in my mind is I think it was against Leeds. It's a chipped goal. Was it against Leeds? It's from the sort of right-hand corner of the penalty area. Mm. And he's sort of heading, dribbling seemingly into a blind alley. And then he just lifts it back over the goalkeeper, who stood completely stranded. I think it's Leeds, not sure. Tweet in if I'm wrong. But it's a like beautiful, beautiful chip, as delicate as anything Dennis Bergkamp could have produced.
Mm. He loved a chip, didn't he? He scored a lot of chip goals because there was that one against... I mean, I think my favourite is the one against Everton, where he sort of lobs it over the defender and back over him across Neville Southall. But he did score a lot of chip goals. I remember one as well. It could have been against Sheffield Wednesday or Swindon or somebody. And I think we won the game 7-0. And he just chipped one in from absolutely miles out. You're looking at it and you're thinking, goalkeeper. But it was just so perfect.
Absolutely. I mean, other memories of him... there was a testimonial game at Highbury. I mean, there were a few, obviously. I can't remember whose it was. Might have been Paul Merson, maybe. Graham Ricks played. That's all I remember. This was kind of, again, mid to late 90s, where he was just on unbelievable form. He came on as a sub, I think, and he was sort of climbing over all the advertising hoardings and just messing around. And I think that infectious spirit is what I loved so much about him. I mean, he was so adventurous as a player, but he was also... just like huge, huge fun. And, you know, however irritating he might have become to some people as a pundit, I think his presence on the football field was, you know, always enlivening. And, in terms of specific goals, it is difficult because there were an awful, awful lot, weren't there?
Yes, there were. I think that Everton one is my favourite.
Happy birthday, though. It's quite frightening, actually, that Ian Wright is, I think he's 51. There you go.
51.
Time will take us all. And on that cheery note, let's move on to the next question. This is an interesting one. This is from Toby Westcott White. And he asks, Westcott White, that sounds like the sort of name you might find in Arsenal's youth team, doesn't
it? Yeah, the Arsenal gentleman could have made him up.
Indeed. He asks, is Monreal's solid game at centre-back a consequence of practice or terrible opposition?
I think a combination of the two, to be perfectly honest. He looked quite comfortable against Sunderland as well. Looked comfortable, obviously, against Burnley. There were a couple of moments where, I'm not saying he was Koscielny-esque, but in terms of what he did in sweeping up behind or being the guy with a bit of pace who could sweep up behind Mertesacker when it was required, I think he did that pretty well. He's looked good in the air as well, which has been one of the pluses, I think, of him moving in there, that he has been quite aggressive in the way that he attacks the ball in the air. Considering he is quite short, he's what, 5'10", something like that. But yeah, I mean, I think he admitted himself that he felt it strange playing at centre-half because he spent his entire career as a left-back. And it does take a little bit of time to learn a new position, which is essentially what he's being asked to do. So yeah, I think it's a combo. It's still not an ideal situation for me that he's playing in there. But given the options, I can kind of understand it to a certain extent. If the manager's identified him as his fourth choice centre half, from before the start of the season and when he didn't buy anybody else. Yeah, I mean, I think he's just looked a bit more comfortable, and practice has played a part, and the opposition has played a part also. I mean, the next two games, Anderlecht and Swansea, you know, decent enough teams, but look, you'd expect us to win those. I think it would be a big test, or a much bigger test, when we play Manchester United, if he's got to fill in there, if Koscielny's not back, when he's playing against really top-class players, and like them or not, you know, the Falcao and Rooney and Van Persie will give a defence more trouble than, Boney or whoever the hell plays up front for Anderlecht, and certainly more than whoever plays for Sunderland and Burnley.
Yeah, I mean...
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog.
A week or two ago, I think we were both of a mind to set, play Chambers at centre-back and bring Bellerin at right-back. Given Monreal's sort of relatively comfortable displays, and I think how well Chambers did at right back at the weekend, I thought he was absolutely superb.
Yeah, it was good.
Would you be inclined to kind of stick with this back four for now then? Two clean sheets on the bounce?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you'd change it if it's worked in the last two games. And look, we haven't kept an awful lot of clean sheets this season, so it would seem odd. I think the reason that he has Monreal in there is purely for experience. You know, he wants to play as many of his experienced defenders as he can. You know, Bellerin is a young player with a lot of potential, but, you know, three or four games, that's all he's played. And, you know, it is a lot to expect him to come in and do a job. Like you said, Chambers was very good on Saturday also. I think he struggles a little bit when he faces players with real pace. But I don't think Sunderland had that, and I don't think Burnley had that. So he was pretty comfortable, and they were games that we were on top of for the most part. But you know, a good goal. He really enjoyed his goal. I think that was the first time he's scored a goal in senior football.
So first ever.
Yeah. So there you go. All right. Here's one from Roger Clark. That's at Roger Clark.
Okay.
Yeah, it's quite...
Keep it simple.
Yeah, handy and efficient. He wants to know, are you happy with the Ox's progress? He says, not scoring, assisting, crossing, dribbling, tracking, or shooting. Which seems a bit harsh to me.
It sounds like Roger's not happy.
I don't think he is.
Okay. I think Oxlade-Chamberlain was... You know, I just mentioned Chambers, but I think Oxlade-Chamberlain was also excellent against Burnley. I think it's a strange time to raise that point because I think he had a superb game at the weekend. I think consistency is an issue for him, but I think that will come. You've got to remember how young he still is. I think that sometimes gets overlooked because he's been around for a few years now, but he came in as a teenager and he hasn't had regular football that would help him to iron out those inconsistencies in his game. I think he's a player for whom confidence is really important. You know, he's someone who likes to run at people, who likes to take shots on. He should score more goals because he's got an excellent shot on him. But I do feel like that will come. And I was very encouraged by what I saw against Burnley. I think he'll be hard to displace. I think people say Theo Walcott's back, but I think he's got a fight on his hands in the face of Chamberlain. And yeah, I would say I am content with his performances, especially given how long he missed last season due to injury. What about you?
Yeah, I thought he was a bit indifferent in the first half against Burnley, and there were a couple of moments where he did things wrong and you could see him, the camera close up, and he's berating himself for that. But I thought the second half, one of the issues we've had perhaps is, you know, at 0-0 against opposition like Burnley, we just start too slowly. If you think even back to the game against Hull, the way we started the second half and just never got going. And what he did in the opening 20 seconds of the second half was get the ball, pick it up, tear down the right hand side, and he created a good chance for Mikel Arteta from the edge of the box, which unfortunately fell to his left foot. Had it been on his right foot, I think we probably would have scored. And that gave us just drive and momentum straight away in that second period. So I like that he's a very forward thinking player, and I agree with you that he can do better in terms of his goal scoring. He's only got one so far this season, but I think that'll come. His age is still, he's still pretty young. He hasn't quite got a nailed down position in the team, which I'm not entirely sure helps him settle, if you know what I mean. That he could play on the left, he could play in midfield, he could play on the right. Mm-hmm. He's sometimes been asked to play deeper in the midfield. And I think that's a little bit of an issue too, but that'll come in time. But yeah, no, I'm happy with him overall. I think he's a good addition to the squad. He's got real pace as well, which I think sometimes gets overlooked. And I think, you know, just a bit more patience is required with Oxlade-Chamberlain. It'll come good.
I think as well, he's got, as well as pace, he's got that kind of muscularity that is so useful. And I have noticed this season, he's been very effusive in his praise of Alexis Sanchez, and you do wonder if we talk about other players following that example. I think in Oxlade-Chamberlain you have seen that a bit. He's closing down a lot more than he has in previous seasons. He's prepared to take players on one-on-one and trust his strength to get past them. So I think he's benefiting from playing alongside someone like that, and I think he's definitely on the right trajectory. It might not be as quick as we might have imagined when he first burst onto the scene, you know, a couple of years ago. But I think he suffered from injuries and, as you say, not having a consistent place in the side. But I think he's making progress and he's in a decent shape at the moment.
Yeah, cool. All right, next question.
Is it me?
Yes.
Okay, this question is from iGillette. Don't know what that signifies. And he, she, it asks, after his 10-minute cameo on Saturday, do you think Podolski deserves a start ahead of Cazorla on the left-hand side?
Maybe he could do it tomorrow night against Anderlecht. I mean, it was a cracking cameo, wasn't it, from Podolski? He was so unlucky not to score. The keeper made a brilliant save. You know what we should do in future is, it's 10:42, that's bin lorry time outside your house. We should try
and
work the recording when the bin lorry isn't coming. But anyway, he was unlucky not to score. Hit the post with a shot that he absolutely smashed, and the keeper made a brilliant save. And I think maybe with Cazorla, the pressure of not scoring is maybe beginning to tell a little bit on him. There was one where he cut back. It could have been, I think it was first half anyway, but the ball was cut back to him and he fizzed a volley and it curled just wide of the post.
Oof,
and had he been
close,
had he been maybe 5 yards further out, you know, the curl on that would have taken it into the goal, and you could just see him looking at it going, oh god, I can't believe this. And then the other shot was blocked brilliantly by the defender when he was following up. And you know, I think you have to give him credit for being in the right position to have those chances, but clearly his finishing is letting him down at this moment in time. So maybe he could give Podolski a run on the left-hand side against Anderlecht. You know, Podolski scored a very important goal, didn't he, against Anderlecht in the last game. And I do think there is a need to if you want players like Podolski to come on and be able to do a job, I think you have to give them more minutes. I don't think he's ever going to be a first-team regular anymore. Podolski is not going to start a lot of games unless we have some serious injuries. But there's no doubt that he's a player that has the quality to make an impact. So, yeah, I wouldn't be against that.
Cool. I mean, Podolski put out another one of his sort of Instagram messages. Did you see that?
No.
Yesterday, I think it was. I think it was something about how, you know, we are patient, we wait for our chance or something like that.
Mm.
And I do wonder if his chance might come against Anderlecht. He had a decent cameo. That shot that hit the post was pretty incredible, wasn't it?
Yeah.
If that had gone in, I think we would have remembered it for a long time. Goal may still be shaking from that one. And I think, yeah, Santi, I think, is struggling a little bit for his best form. I think he still plays an important role in the side in terms of adding fluency, and his movement's very intelligent. He interchanges positions well. But I think Anderlecht may be a game in which we can give Podolski a run out. And I do think with these squad players, it is important to give them a start every now and again, just so they retain a level of sharpness so that when they are needed to come off the bench, they're useful.
What did you make of the decision, and I know that you can't maybe read a lot into it, that when Yaya Sanogo was fit, he came back on the bench ahead of Joel Campbell.
Mm.
And I was tweeting about that on Saturday, and a lot of people were saying, well, clearly Campbell is a much better player. And it's very difficult to defend Sonogo's goal-scoring record because, A, he doesn't have one, and B, he doesn't have one. Whereas Campbell obviously has a track record of goals down the years. My feeling on it is, though, that there were options for the manager in the wide positions, that he had Podolski for the left-hand side, he had Walcott for the right-hand side, he had Rosicki that he could have played in either of those positions as well. But if something had happened to Danny Welbeck, for example, he didn't have the out-and-out striker. That would be my only reason to keep Sanogo, or to put Sanogo on the bench.
Yeah, I don't think he sees Campbell as an option as that kind of lone striker in that Welbeck role, say. Mm. Probably because his ball retention might not be quite up there. You know, we saw against Southampton in the Capital One Cup, he conceded possession quite frequently. I think it didn't surprise me enormously. We know that Arsenal has huge faith in Sanogo, and I think he definitely will be above Campbell in Arsenal's pecking order.
Is it a fair comparison, though, Sanogo and Campbell? Is it not a bit like comparing a centre-half with a fullback? If you know what I mean, because, you know, Sanogo isn't a guy who can play wide, whereas Campbell is.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the thing is, Campbell did play, albeit because they had an injury, I think, to their main striker, Saborio, maybe. But Campbell did play as a lone striker for Costa Rica in the World Cup.
Mm.
So some people would suggest, well, you know, he is comparable. He can play in the same role. It's a very different way of playing, though. They were playing as a team who sat very deep and just needed someone to basically chase things down up top. I do think it's tricky for Campbell either way you look at it. You know, he's behind Sanogo, it seems, in the pecking order for a centre forward spot, and he's behind an awful lot of players in the wide areas. You know, we've just talked about Oxlade-Chamberlain, we've talked about Theo Walcott coming back, Podolski struggling for a game. Campbell's not going to jump ahead of that, any of those in the queue.
Mesut Ozil still to come back.
Yeah, of course, the famous winger. So I think there's going to be a hell of a lot of competition. Serge Gnabry, you know, or Gnabry,
yeah,
rather.
Yeah.
One who we haven't seen for a while, who is going to be back in contention soon. You do feel that the writing may be on the wall for Campbell. It looked as if he might even go towards the end of the summer, the window. I think the Olivier Giroud injury might have impacted on indecision there. But I'd be a little bit surprised to see him stay beyond January at this point.
Yeah, same, I have to say. I think that was quite telling that, you know, his place in the squad is such that when Walcott's back, when we've got Oxlade-Chamberlain, when we've got Cazorla, Podolski, Ozil, even Alexis for the wide positions, that, you know, Capital One Cup was about as much as he could hope for, maybe an FA Cup game if he's still here in January, but bar a catastrophe in terms of the injuries, it's difficult to see him difficult to see him getting a go. While we're on Podolski, Anton Berlvard. Sorry, Anton, I know I didn't do that right, but he wants to know, Anton Bjørvald, I think that's more like it. Okay. He wants to know, is Prince Poldi the best super sub in the Wenger era? If not, who is, and what are your top three subs of all time?
Oh, wow. Top three subs of all time.
Yeah.
Dear, dear. It's hard. You've got to have Kaba Diawara, so it's difficult. Let me have a think. Podolski is pretty effective. I can think of several games where he's made an impact coming on. That one at West Ham last season stays strong in the mind. Obviously, there was Anderlecht recently too.
Yeah.
Subs. Help me out here. Who've I not got?
I don't know. I was struggling with this one as well. I was hoping you would be.
Canu was always quite helpful to bring off the bench.
Mm.
But he started the game where he scored the hat-trick against Chelsea, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He did. He was on the pitch from the start. It was Canu and Davor Suker up front that day.
Halcyon days.
Thierry Henry on the bench.
Wow. Other super subs.
Mm. It's hard, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, it's an aspect of Wenger's game that has been criticised, hasn't it? His ability to make game-changing substitutions.
Yeah.
Maybe we're seeing why. I'm just trying to think back to the kind of Invincibles era. You know, you think about the role Ole Solskjaer played at Manchester United. Was there anyone doing a similar thing for us, really? I don't know, because in that squad, you know, you had players who came in from the start, often people like Ray Parlour and Edu, mm. and were very, very capable, but you don't really think of them sort of coming on to change a match.
No, it always struck me that we had more of the Christopher Ray, Kaba Diawara type subs who we'd send on and kind of hope that they could do something, but generally they didn't.
Yeah, and even in that era, we were quite blessed with reserve goalkeepers who would come in and perform outstandingly. And before that, you know, you think of Alex Malinger.
Mm.
But again, that's more from the start. We've had some excellent reserves, but in terms of people who would actually change the course of a match, I am struggling here.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, I'm also struggling. So we'll throw this one open to the listeners. They can leave a comment if they want on SoundCloud, or just hit us up on Twitter and remind us of all the ones that we've probably forgotten.
Yeah, I'm sure there are some really obvious ones. Do shout at us and let us know.
Yeah. All right. Go on. Let's have another one.
You want another one?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. This is good. This is from Ali White. And he asks, if given the chance to poke Jose Mourinho in the face with an object, what object would you choose?
Just to poke him in the face? Because a poke by its very nature isn't anything.
Because, I mean, you could say a bullet, couldn't you?
Yeah, but you would just, like, poke a bullet into his face. It would make no difference. It would have to be something smeared with something, wouldn't it, for it to be in any way effective or to get the required effect, if I'm, you know, trying to pick up what's being said here, that this would be in some way damaging to Jose Mourinho. So perhaps something like a stick covered in a new strain of smallpox.
Oh, okay, that's good.
Yeah?
Because in poking him with it, you could transmit said disease
mm-hmm.
and thus have a more permanent effect than your average poke does.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than him just going, ow, that was slightly uncomfortable for a second, he would then fall prey to smallpox. I mean, the thing is, though, we'd have to make sure that the rest of us were inoculated against this new strain of smallpox. Otherwise, we would create some kind of pandemic.
Yeah.
We could bring about the end of the human race, which, while on the one hand would no longer have Mourinho in it, which is good, the rest of us would be dead, which is bad.
Mm. It seems like a small price to pay for a prank on Jose Mourinho, I have to say.
Yeah.
I think that's a good suggestion. But again, the logistics seem difficult, don't they? The inoculation process will take time.
It will. Like, yeah, quite a number of years. And by that point, would it be worth it? Yes, it would, but still.
It would take a lot. Let's embark upon it swiftly.
Yeah, all right. I have another question here. Or do why? Yes, I do. It comes from Rob.
An element of suspense introduced to the podcast there.
At Gunnar UK. And he says, there's quite a bit of I agree on the podcast. What would you say is the biggest Arsenal-related thing you two disagree on?
Oh, that's a really good question.
It is.
Do you agree that it's a good question?
No.
There we go, problem solved.
Yeah, that answered that one.
I don't know. What do we disagree on?
Fundamentally, I don't know.
Well, I didn't rate Philippe Senderos as highly as you.
That's true. But then again, I don't think you're alone there.
No.
I don't think you're alone.
I don't know. I mean, I think the problem is the kind of dichotomy that divides Arsenal fans is the kind of awful, you know, are you pro Arsene Wenger or anti Arsene Wenger, right?
Right.
And I think that as far as that fence goes, I don't think that either of us sort of have a definitive. We haven't got sort of AKB tattooed to us in any particular part of our anatomy. Do you know what I mean? There's kind of a, or the alternative. I think we're both more fluid in our thinking.
Yeah, we're not. We're not extremists. Is that what? Yeah.
No, not in that area. I mean, in a lot of other areas, I would say.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Particularly with animal rights and stuff,
exactly,
and the way
yeah.
we set fire to mink farms and stuff.
Yeah, obviously. But in terms of football managers, no. I don't know what we disagree on. I mean, that's such a boring response, isn't it?
Yeah. I should probably just edit this question out now.
Yeah. Do you think that... exactly, because it's kind of an implied criticism, isn't it? I mean, you know, thanks for listening and everything. But.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Do you have another question? Maybe we can disagree on that. Maybe, you know, it'll happen organically. Well, we disagreed last week, did we not?
On what?
On the issue of whatever the would you rather was.
Oh, right. Okay. So well, this is a good one that I think... I don't know. This is a really difficult question.
Right.
I'm going to ask you now. It's actually not a kind question. It's quite cruel. I think it's a bit weird.
Okay.
But in order to, you know, facilitate some disagreement... Which of the following... This is from Selbridge Gooner. Which of the following would you save from drowning? A bag of puppies... Or Alexis Sanchez?
That is really difficult. The thing is that, yeah, that's difficult because number one, you need Alexis Sanchez because he's awesome.
Yeah.
But number two,
I know how you feel about puppies though.
A bag of puppies would also be awesome. And if you saved a bag of puppies, you would have puppies. And they could climb on you and slurp you and stuff. And you could, let's face it, spend another £30 million on a player like Alexis Sanchez.
That's good. I was worried you were going to say train one of the puppies to play as a roving striker in the mould of Alexis Sanchez.
It would depend entirely on the breed of dog.
Right.
Because, you know, I don't think, and I say this from personal experience, that even with the best training in the world, you could ever train a Basset Hound... to be as energetic as Alexis Sanchez. And certainly, he wouldn't be able to leap 6'10" in the air to score the opening goal against Burnley. But a more active kind of breed, whether it's a German Shepherd or a Collie or something like that, some kind of lurcher, they could certainly do the job in terms of their work rate and their engine. But it's a very difficult one. A bag of puppies or Alexis Sanchez? Who would I save?
It's really difficult, isn't it?
Are they crying? Like, is Alexis?
I have to ask why you're asking that.
Well, because I mean, if it's a load of puppies going, or Alexis going, "Ayúdame!" That could make a difference to me,
right? What you, in what way?
That
I'm fascinated by this, like. If the puppies weren't crying, would you assume that they were sort of happy to go and that they were escaping, you know, the problems of their life and you'd relinquish your grasp on them? What's driving this question about the noise they're making.
I just don't think I could. I could listen to the puppies. I don't think I could listen to the puppies crying as they were drowning.
Okay.
But they'd be, yeah, they'd be underwater, so how could they? How could they cry? Or maybe it's just they're just paddling. Are they in a, it's a bag,
just admit
isn't it?
You want Alexis Sanchez dead. You've made it clear.
The puppies are in a bag, right? Is Alexis
Everyone's
Sanchez
in a bag.
Is Alexis is in a bag as well?
No, Alexis Sanchez, it just is a bag of puppies or Alexis Sanchez. He's bagless. He's bag free.
You see, the thing is,
you're looking into his eyes.
The puppies are at a much bigger disadvantage than Alexis Sanchez because, A, if he's not in a bag, he can swim, assuming he's learned to swim. Whereas the puppies are being put in a bag and probably tied, and there's some stones put in the bottom of it, and that seems inordinately cruel to me. So if I had to leap in and save one of them, it would be to save the puppies because they have no chance, whereas Alexis has at least got a chance and he could swim, or, you know, somebody could throw him something. I don't know. That would be me. Puppies.
He calls himself an Arsenal fan, ladies and gentlemen. Can you believe it? He's just allowed Alexis Sanchez to drift to the bottom of the canal. I think you're right, because surely he's a brilliant swimmer. He's brilliant at everything else.
Yeah. Yeah, he must be able to swim like the man from Atlantis.
I imagine. He's probably got gills.
Yeah.
Like in Waterworld.
And webbed things between his hands and feet.
Amazing. Maybe that's how he's able to control the ball so well, because there's no space between his toes. It's all just flesh-filled.
That could be why he was able to jump so high as well, because he can sort of glide like a flying bat. You know, the way they kind of go with their things? Yeah. See? So there you go.
The powers of so many animals.
All right, well, look,
I think there's drill happening, so I think we should call it a day.
I think that might be a good idea. So thank you all for listening. We'll have an Arsecast on Friday, another Arsecast Extra next Monday, when we'll be looking back to the game against Swansea. So until then, have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.